Then they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple and began to drive out those who were selling and those who were buying in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. He was teaching and saying, Is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations? But you have made it into a den of robbers.
When people saw the sign that Jesus had done, feeding the 5,000, they began to say, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world." When Jesus realized that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he withdrew again to the mountain by himself.
Just then, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and started shouting, "Have mercy on me, son of David. My daughter is tormented by a demon." But Jesus did not answer her at all. The disciples came and urged Jesus to send her away. Jesus answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But she came and knelt before Jesus, saying, "Rabbi, help me." He answered, "It is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs." She said, "Yes, Rabbi, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table."
So they watched him and sent spies who pretended to be honest in order to trap him in what he said, so as to hand him over to the jurisdiction and the authority of the governor. So they asked him, "Teacher, we know that you are right in what you say and teach, and you show deference to no one, but teach the way of God in accordance with truth. Is it lawful for us to pay taxes to the emperor or not?" But he perceived their craftiness and said to them, "Show me a denarius. Whose head and title does it bear?" They said, "The emperor's." He said to them, "Then give to the emperor the things that are the emperor's, and to God the things that are God's."
From that time on, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and undergo great suffering at the hands of the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "God forbid it, Lord, this must never happen to you." But he turned to said Peter, "Get behind me, Satan, you are my stumbling block, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." The collectors of the temple tax came to Peter. Jesus said to him, "However, so that we do not give offense to them, go to the sea and cast a hook. Take the first fish that comes up, and when you open its mouth, you will find a coin. Take that and give it to them for you and me."
Jesus straightened up and said to them, "Let anyone among you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." They went away one by one.
Michelle, we invite you to speak to us according to what God has put within you to share.
Good morning. It was mentioned a few weeks ago that our theme this fall is exploring communication between ourselves and God, as well as communication with each other. Pastor Mesvin has been focusing on communication specific to the questions that Jesus asked. Today, I'm focusing on our communication with each other while looking at Jesus as an example. How do we communicate differences of opinion and make decisions? How do we communicate when there is the potential for conflict? Uh-oh, I said the C word. By way of background, I don't particularly like conflict, and sometimes I'm scared of it. I'd avoid it if I could. But my teenage experience of family and congregational division within the same year showed me how impossible that can be, which is probably why I chose to study it in university. I majored in biblical and theological studies, and I minored in peace and conflict transformation. Most peace programs refer to conflict resolution, but in the absence of resolution, I like to hold out hope for transformation, like transforming a tightrope into a safety net. Much of the material I'm drawing on for this service solidified for me in a course I took on congregational peace building in the summer of 2005, including this painting and a prayer that I'll share at the end. So when you came in, you were offered a stone. Stones come up a lot throughout scriptures as we have heard and sung. Altars of stones were set up at locations of significant encounters with God, physical reminders of who we are as God's people. Our ancestors also used stones for building up, tearing down, and even passing judgment. We hear how God can turn a heart of stone into a heart of flesh, and that if human voices fail to proclaim Jesus as he entered Jerusalem, the stones would have cried out in their place. Some of us collect stones. I know I do. They can be kind of neat to hold on to, but what is their function? Do we use our stones to build, to mark boundaries, to remember special places or events? Do we choose stones based on color, shape, size, texture, type, or fossilization? Another fantastic physical connection to ancient memory. Or is it based on some unique feature inside, only visible if chipped or broken? Sometimes we choose the stones ourselves, and other times we don't. There are times when I have relied on other people's pockets for my collection. And I currently share a collection pouch and my pockets with my daughters. Like us, each stone is different and has been shaped by a particular environment and set of experiences. In any case, the stones we carry closest, the ones hidden away and held tight in sweaty hands, have the greatest potential for harm. Falling with a stone in your hand can hurt. It can cause damage. And if it stays hidden, there's a chance of infection that impacts the whole body. But if the hurt hand was opened, yes, the stone would be visible. And regardless of whether the stone is kept or set aside, the wound could heal. When a person can acknowledge what it is they hold on to, sharing its significance, and allowing others to join in an exploration, destructive potential is limited, and amazing things can happen instead. Perhaps some of you recall the story of stone soup, sometimes called button soup, and it may have some resemblance to Lisa's treasure soup. The stone soup premise is this: food and resources were scarce, and no one in the community had any to spare for the stranger who came knocking at their door. Some people declined politely, others less so, and still others hid and didn't answer at all. Recognizing the situation, the hungry stranger publicly offered to instead provide stone soup for everyone else. It was rather difficult without a pot or water, but with a warm fire and nearby well, someone got curious enough to share a pot. Bit by bit, and the stranger put their stones in the pot. So bit by bit, more people got curious, got engaged, and began to contribute. A little salt here, a little pepper there, some potatoes, or carrots, or onion, or herbs, or beans, or whatever was on hand. Never much of anything, because sometimes scarcity is very real, but always just enough. Soup is a slow process. Gradually, the aroma succeeded in its invitation, melting reluctance, and eventually everyone was present, and the stone soup was declared ready. So the whole community gathered and ate together, served by the stranger in their midst. And like the loaves and fishes, not only was there enough for all, there was even leftovers. And this particular story ends with a community requesting to keep the stones for fear of going hungry again. So what does this have to do with communication or conflict? I learned that we all have different goals and styles when it comes to communication and decision-making. Intentionally or unintentionally, we hold on to those things. In this painting, each hand is holding a stone. On the stones and within the hands themselves are represented our five senses. And the location and color of the hands is connected to styles of engagement in relation to content and relationship goals. Because awareness of our own priorities and preferences can make a difference in how we choose to engage. Here I'm going to define priorities as specific types of goals or interactions for decisions, and preferences as a style of interaction or type of process. Priorities can include content goals, relational goals, identity goals, and process goals. Some people don't care as much about the outcome of a decision as whether they feel comfortable with their participation in the process and how that process was communicated. For other people, something could come up that is so important to them that they would do almost anything to achieve a particular outcome. Yet other folks' main concern is the impact of either outcome or process on the relationships of everyone involved, and what either process or conclusion says about who we are. Each person holds within them a beautifully complicated mix of goals. And this is compounded even more when many people are trying to decide something together. Some priorities are based on reason, and others on gut or emotion, and all are wrapped up in our own narratives. The strongest narrative is that of identity, and unless that is adequately addressed, nothing is truly settled. There is a story of a church in Scotland that under the leadership of a new rector wanted to switch from pews to chairs. There was a common desire for multi-use worship space and greater community engagement, and yet one elder staunchly refused to support the decision. This person stated empathetically that the pew where they sat in for worship was the same one their family members had been sitting in every generation since the founding of the church, and therefore they could not and would not move. There was no reasoning or room for compromise. The rector did some research and arranged a meeting with the elder. Together they looked through the archives, paying particular attention to all the various configurations of the sanctuary. Seeing for themselves that the pews had already moved many times to meet the needs of the congregation, freed the elder to withdraw their opposition in full confidence that they were not compromising their identity or connection to family and church tradition. moving from priorities to style of preferences. The style preferences usually include competing, collaborating, compromising, accommodating, or avoiding. Some of these things seem polar opposites, physically resistant to one another, and perhaps they are. But a pole does not exist in isolation. As demonstrated in the children's time, we live in the tension between them. There's a graph often used to show these in relation to content and relational goals or priority for self or for other. Each style presents situational benefits and challenges. Using a fictional example to describe them, we can say there is one orange left and both of us want it. With a competing style, both of us say we want the orange, and the person who wants it most gets the orange. With an avoiding style, one or both of us say we want the orange, and when we realize we both want it, we put it back and don't talk about it. With an accommodating style, both of us say we want the orange and then start insisting that the other person have it. With a compromising style, we both say we want the orange and then we reluctantly cut it in half. And with a collaborating style, we both say we want the orange and start discussing why, and eventually find out that one of us wants to make juice and the other wants to grate up the peel for cake. Each of these styles takes different amounts of time and energy. And depending on context and available resources, we may prefer one over another. But our favorite doesn't always mean it's the best choice. Worldview also impacts how we perceive various styles. Some societies value family or group harmony above individual needs, where other societies value individual expression and autonomy. When it comes to games or governance, some people like creating or reading through complicated rule structures, where others just want to get on with it and learn as they go. And it's all valid. Sometimes style preferences are encouraged or discouraged from a young age based on gender, personality, and the values of our caregivers. Each of us have preferred and/or default styles, which can change based on context and experience. We are all different, and we are all made in the image of God. It is helpful to note, particularly for those of us holding tight to our identity as people of God's peace, that Jesus used all five styles. If you remember the varied gospel texts that were read, the connection between them is that they are each examples of Jesus using a different style or combination of styles in addressing and engaging interpersonal conflict. When did Jesus compete or command? When he was challenging injustice or exercising authority. When did Jesus compromise? When it wasn't about justice. When did Jesus collaborate? When it was time to get creative. When did Jesus accommodate? When he realized someone else was right. When did Jesus avoid? When staying or speaking could only make things worse. So what is my goal in bringing up conflict theories as part of a series on communication? I'm really excited about the net metaphor of diversity. Seeing diversity as a safety net and encouraging awareness of more strands as a way of growing strength. That's why there are threads glued to the canvas. Not every tension is a problem to be solved. It's part of the space we live and worship in. I'm also hoping that by slowly increasing individual and collective awareness of priorities and preferences, which we'll explore more in Sunday school, we can be more intentional about when and how we utilize the various styles. I believe a congregation is healthiest when decisions are made in the context of shared awareness and appreciation for the stones that we each carry and the varied threads of connection between us. I will close with the prayer I wrote in 2005 that continues to be my challenge and my hope. Jesus, you overturned tables and drove the money changers from the temple. You claimed your authority. Build in me the strength to challenge injustices and to overcome all within me competing for your will. Jesus, you avoided earthly kingship and adoring crowds. Release me from my dependencies. Teach me to avoid the temptations of praise and lust of power. Turn me upside down and open my eyes to see and worship you in your own image, not mine. Jesus, you both challenged and acknowledged the rules by which humans govern. You paid taxes out of the mouth of a fish. Teach me to seek and appreciate unexpected alternatives and unique compromise. Develop in me the strength and merriment of heart to uphold standards of accountability, including my own. Jesus, you transformed a personal and structural critique into a constructive widening of your ministry and extension of your grace. Center me in your grace to accept challenge without offense or defensiveness. Help me to discern when accommodation to another is an expression of both my character and calling. Jesus, you reaffirmed the human worth and status of the disgraced by calling everyone's behavior to account to a higher standard. Fill me with the courage and ability to publicly name and retain moral expectation in a way that expresses and extends unconditional love, upholding the intrinsic value of each person. Make me witness to the healing power of collaboration. Outraged prophet, humble servant, witty witness, light to the nations, wise questioner. Jesus, you are the Son of God. Teach me, Lord, to walk in all your diverse and mysterious ways, I pray. Amen.